Hello and welcome to Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week we've got a recent fundraising single from acoustic pop duo, The Portraits. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is an emerging talent as a children's book author. Inspired by his own local natural surroundings, Will Hamilton Davis has recently crowdfunded and self-published his debut story, The Shrew with the Flu. Coming from a large family where he looks after his younger siblings, Will has a clear passion and skill for getting kids to connect with the environment around them through amusing but heartwarming writing. We spoke over Zoom to talk about his journey from story enthusiast to storyteller. Will, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thanks for having me on, Lewis.
You are in Chewmagna, and you're not our first guest from the area. We've had Joe Kelly, who runs the Chew Valley Distillery, gin makers up there. What would be your recommendation for, let's say, 24 hours in your neck of the woods?
Good question. I mean, first of all, Joe Kelly is, I almost feel like an indirect family friend of ours, because we're friends with Don Kelly, who's also local. And actually, perhaps his restaurant, The Lazy Lobster, is going to be somewhere where I'd recommend people go for dinner if they're here in the evening. But as far as like a day in and around the Chew Valley, I don't know whether anybody would be following me on Instagram, but I've always posted recently about this local waterfall in Chew Stoke. And there's this kind of windy path that takes you through some kind of foresty trails and takes you to this lake almost, or this little waterfall, and that you can get in and actually swim in, which is crazy. So I think I'd probably recommend people go and check something like that out. And there's all of these little paths and windy leafy trees and all of that kind of good stuff in these almost like these back paths in the countryside around Chew Valley and the kind of Chew Stoke area. And so huge recommendation would be go and explore some of those trails, and even Chew Valley Lake, the salt and malt, go and grab some fish and chips there, go and have a wander around the lake or cycle if you can. And for me, those have always been the best day experiences. I think where you're kind of, you're out in nature, you know, you're enjoying the sun and you're just, yeah, you're just in the moment and very present with what you're doing. So that'll probably be my recommendation.
Speaking of nature, you're also involved in a local tree planting initiative as well. What can you tell me about that?
So I recently got involved with an initiative called Chew Valley Plants Trees. And I've got to be honest, I didn't realize that it was so easy to get involved in these kind of things. And I found for the past few years, as a 23-year-old that is dying to be doing more for the environment and the planet and being a bit more active with kind of stuff, I didn't realize that just around the corner, there's this whole setup with a charity called Black to Nature that often take kind of underprivileged inner city schools. And a couple of months ago, having gotten involved with that and gone along to one of these tree planting days, I was lucky enough that I got to meet all of the organizers there and just said to them, look, how can I be more involved? And having had a bit of an introductory chat and almost the typical Zoom call with what feels like a gazillion people on it, we kind of got together and have been trying to find more local farmers and people like that to help plant trees all around the local area.
We'll talk a lot more about your book later, but when you were thinking about the world in which your story takes place, was that based on real life woods near you?
I feel like it's hard to deny the resemblance of like a lot of the local area in the illustrations and things like that. And actually, I remember when I was talking to Jen, the incredible illustrator that worked on The Shrew with the Flu, I remember printing out and kind of putting together a bit of a collage of different types of trees. And I'm sure you can imagine that all of the trees that I'm putting on there seem to be the trees that I'm looking at all the time as I'm driving and walking and cycling around the local area. So yeah, totally. I think it's one of those things that whether you are trying to escape from it or not, I think you always find that those kind of things eke into your work, and you always find that the local imprint always seems to find a way into my stories.
You were telling me that you grew up in the Tube Magnet area as well, but that your dad grew up in Bristol. So your family's always been in the West Country?
Yeah, so I remember actually having a conversation with my mum a few months ago. It feels like when you get older, you start having those conversations where you almost piece together all of the backstory of your parents and your relatives. And my mum actually came from further down south in Cornwall, and my dad was always brought up in Bristol. And so I think from that, I don't know how my mum ended up in Bristol. I think she said that at one point in time, she had like hitchhiked her way halfway around the country and ended up getting a lift to Bristol or something crazy like that, and ended up staying here. And ever since, yeah, my family's been based here. And my dad will, as I've mentioned before to you, Lewis, I think that my dad could name pretty much every road name. It seems to be one of his like party tricks. If you ask to name somewhere in Bristol, he seems to know every postcode, road name, you name it. He's kind of been there and got a story from it. But I'm sure all of the parents in and around that area kind of feel that way.
You're one of six siblings. Where do you fall in the bunch?
So I always describe our siblings as almost like the OGs and then the rest of them, because there are the three eldest ones, which is Nathan, who's the oldest, me, who's the middle, and then Ed, who's the youngest out of the almost like the original three siblings. And then later on, we've now got 10-year-old Max, we've got 7-year-old Emily, and then I think Evie's 8 now, actually. It's always tricky trying to remember the ages of them, but so I'm in the upper half of them, if you like.
So growing up within that sort of that original three, as you mentioned, there was presumably less competition for time from your parents.
I tell you what, Lewis, I saw a video a couple weeks ago of like back when we were all kids, and when we were babies, I don't know how my parents coped. We were all born in 18 month stints. So we had Nathan was born, 18 months later I was born, 18 months later Ed was born, and it just looks crazy. Like when you look back at these videos, it's kind of like everyone almost batting each other out the way to try and get mum's attention. Or I think at one point I'm there trying to like shove Ed over so that I can dance in front of my parents, like, and just be the most wild, energetic thing, just so that we can have that attention. It's the strangest thing. I don't know whether you're part of a big family at all. Do you have many?
I'm one of four, and yeah, we're relatively close together in age as well. But I think, you know, there's always different characteristics between children, and I was always a little bit more of the quiet one.
I can relate to that. I think that I always talk to people about, I think when people ask me if I'm an introvert or an extrovert, I normally tell people that I'm an introverted extrovert. It's like all of this kind of, I love having a chat with other people and I love learning about the world. And I find that the best way to do that is always in conversations with other people. But at the same time, I don't know whether you'd relate to this whole process of loving to almost take those thoughts away and digest the world almost on my own a lot of the time. And I think that's really where the writing comes in.
You're clearly very attuned to the natural world. Is that something that you were encouraged to explore and the environment around you when you were growing up?
I almost feel the inverse is true, which seems to be more and more the case actually when I have conversations with people nowadays, that while I've always been a quite a reflective and caring person who's always wanted to give, you know, the best representation of myself to people and be seen in the highest regard. I think at the same time, I grew up, I had privilege when I was growing up. I think, you know, we had quite a big house when we were younger. And I think a lot of that, all of that extra stuff, it almost feels like when I got to my late teens and being that reflective person, kind of felt myself leaning more towards the side of kind of simplicity and almost wanting to throw all that stuff away and go and live in the woods. And so I think actually having had the opposite, having had a lot of noise and a lot of stuff, I think that I've probably found some peace in nature. And it's an element of being able to go and digest the world in somewhere that's quite quiet. And, you know, you just feel like you're kind of there with yourself. That's really special to me.
This may have been a memory from when you were a little bit younger, but do you remember being told bedtime stories yourself?
Yeah, definitely. And actually a little bit out of the ordinary, my dad used to make up these spontaneous bedtime stories when we were younger. And I remember that he would often, we'd all go into one room. So it would be my dad and the three of us siblings, older siblings. And he would ask us all to pick like a character that we wanted to be in. I think it was like sometimes a piece of equipment, he'd say, or like a weapon or something like that, and a vehicle. And then he'd always create these stories just completely spontaneously and off the cuff and somehow weave together all of these different elements that we'd kind of put into them. And for me, that sense of having a different story every night that we didn't know where it was going, we couldn't possibly know, was quite crazy looking back. And there, I don't think there were actually that many kids' parents that would put the energy into trying to create a story like that. But maybe to some extent, that's a bit of inspiration that I hadn't noticed before.
I suppose having a natural storyteller being a fundamental part of your life is going to point you in that kind of direction to some extent.
Yeah, probably. And although I almost sometimes lock horns with my dad because we're both perfectionists when it comes to writing, but I'm the one that's gone and kind of studied journalism and things like this. And sometimes he thinks he's right, I think I'm right. And to be completely honest, they're probably both right, but just in, you know, in different places. And I think a lot of the time you're right, actually. The inspiration from having a bit of a natural storyteller parent, but also that sense of setting a benchmark, I think, at the same time, has always helped me strive to be a bit of a storyteller. And not only that, but to try and tell good stories as well.
What kind of stories do you remember being captured by?
I'm not sure people will even know the stories that I mentioned, but I don't know if have you ever heard of the mole that knew it was none of his business? It was like one like that.
No.
Lewis, it's totally ridiculous. It's all about this mole that walks around with a poo on its head. And I'm so sure, because I looked this up a few years ago and it is like a bestseller, and I'm sure it's like a much loved book by many, but it is totally ridiculous. So stories like that, The Faraway Tree, I remember my mum reading me that book. And is that Enid Blyton?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember being read pages of that at bedtime and slowly making our way through that story. And actually that kind of mythical element, I always really liked that element of almost like unspoken magic. It was like realism, but smashed together with like something that almost could be Harry Potter.
What grabbed your attention at school?
Let me think. If I'm looking back at school, I think that my youngest years, I talk about trying to grab the attention of my parents when we were very young. And I can't help but think that at primary school, and you know, anybody that's listening from Somerset and knows Chew Magna Primary, that's where I went initially. And I just remember running around the playground desperately trying to impress people. And I think a lot of my younger years were spent with quite a lot of insecurities, I think. And actually, even when I moved into a school in Bristol, I remember feeling quite dissatisfied to begin with my friendship groups. I remember looking at these naturally sporty kids that were like the hubs of energy in life, and everybody would just gravitate towards them for friendships, and thinking, how can I be a little bit more like that? And actually, a lot of those years, I think, taught me a lot of life lessons about almost this value exchange and this element of, like, you know, being somebody that other people want to be around, and having a bit more of a appreciation for other people's motivations and aspirations. And it's not just a case of, hey, you're my friend and you're not. It's also, look, like, I want to help you through life, and a lot of the value you bring in your skills and values and all of that kind of stuff makes me want to be around you. And I think that understanding what people want and what people are driven by and how you can help fit into that has been a big part of my younger years.
You mentioned those sort of insecurities, and as someone who admits to being quite introspective, why do you think those showed themselves? Where do you think they came from?
That is quite a quite a question to unpack. I mean, I think a lot of those insecurities probably come from being a very competitive and aspirational child, but my older brother was always very naturally gifted. And so I think even from a very young age, seeing somebody that could kind of switch it on when he needed to and just perform, I always looked at that and thought that it was really impressive, and would look at the way other people looked at that and the kind of sense of awe that a lot of people had around his natural talents. But he was a logical thinker in a way that maybe I'm not as numerical as he is. And so actually, I always found that being more creative and sometimes going against the grain in the things that I'm doing became the way that I could stand out. And so I think a lot of those insecurities probably came from this element of, like, I want to be more like my older brother, but how can I do that if I'm not a mathsy person and I'm not, you know, necessarily naturally gifted at these things? It's like, okay, well, I can graft, I can work as hard as possible, and I can play to my strengths. And my strengths, I think, just over time became writing and stories and messaging, and I think people really at the heart of all of that.
Looking back, what do you wish you'd been told at that time? What do you know now that you wish you'd known then?
I think about this quite a lot, actually. And whenever with such younger siblings, a lot of the time what I'm thinking about is, you know, how can I be the right role model for them as an older brother? And actually, how can I speak to them in a way that is empowering and not dismissive of their own ideas? And actually, I think it's probably just a case of understanding yourself and taking the time to be patient with your own decisions. It's like, it's okay to be wrong. And it is such a strength to try and give something a go. And I was having a conversation actually at work recently about having this culture of it not being a win or a lose situation, but playing for the sake of playing. And actually, that it's not that if somebody else scores a goal and they've won, it's okay, well, you've had a learning experience. It all really plays into these bigger life lessons. And so I think if I could go back and tell myself anything at that time, it's like, first of all, good on you for trying and keep going. And second of all, it's probably, you know, it's all right to get it wrong. You're going to be okay. Like, ride that wave and yeah, that I think kids don't get told enough, you know, it's all right. You're trying and that's enough.
You talked about sort of owning your way of doing things and, you know, the creativity, the personal angle, I suppose, as your way of expressing yourself. Was there a line in the sand? Was there a moment where you actively decided to pursue that and sort of make that your own?
I think there have been lots of times where I put a line in the sand and probably scribbled it out again and put the line somewhere else. I specifically remember a couple of conversations with people over the years that have been like really impactful for me. And actually, one of those was in my secondary school with my English teacher. And it was during this period when I was on a mission to make friends at the time. And for me, that was, right, let's be disruptive. Let's be the class clown. Let's do as much as I can to kind of get eyes on me. And, you know, I hate to say it, but for a lot of that time period, that was why people were friends with me. And, you know, it's another story in itself around why maybe they weren't the best friendships for me, actually. But I remember him sitting me down one day and saying, hey, look, like you're talented, you've got potential. And potential always felt like a word that stuck with me over the years. And actually him saying, you could be great, but you need to change. And actually, I can read your work and I think that it's so different from what other people are writing, but you're so focused on everything outside of that and trying to impress people that actually you're not taking the time to hone your craft and be better at the things that you already are good at. So yeah, it all seems to come back to those conversations around playing to your strengths. And when you talk about a line in the sand, it's like, actually, I think it's that guidance and having a sense of direction and continuity, like sticking to one thing and just really giving it a go before you, you know, flicker between lots of different things and try and juggle too many tasks maybe at one time.
You mentioned earlier that you went to study journalism at university. That was up in Newcastle. Mm. How much of a fresh start did you see that as?
It's funny actually, because while Newcastle is a world away from Bristol, I followed my brother there. So as somebody that talks about having, you know, tried to almost break away from my brother's talents and be, you know, credited for my own skills, I think actually, you know, I also come back to the fact that he's a big inspiration of mine, and watching him go to Newcastle a year before me and love it and kind of completely evolve as a person, for me, I was like, I want that. Like, I want to do the same thing. So I followed him up there, and I'm not even sure whether he liked it at the time, because it was kind of inviting myself into a world that he had all to himself at the time. But I think it did bring us closer together. And actually, as far as a fresh start, you know, there was, so it felt like I had enough family up there to feel safe and comfortable, but still be so far apart from everybody that was down south in Bristol that I could just be myself and let my hair down a bit and actually just give a few different versions of me a go and land on where I felt comfortable, I think.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent with tracks from local acts in each podcast. The portraits are husband and wife singer-songwriters Jeremy and Lorraine Millington. Their musical marriage brings together the Southwest and Galway in Ireland to create stripped-back, straightforward writing. Known as much for their political and social messages as their melodies, the portraits have released 8 studio albums and gained a cult following. In December 2020, they hit the charts with their version of Together in Electric Dreams, featuring musicians from around Somerset, released in memory of those lost during the COVID pandemic.
As a young adult then, you found yourself taking on a new role in entertaining your much younger siblings. Have you found that's come naturally?
I kind of didn't even realise it was happening at the time. I think there's something very strange about when I look back now, you as a older teen who was seeing my stepmom be pregnant and then give birth. I remember we were watching One Born Every Minute for like on repeat up until Max was born. And it's just weird how you become almost like invested in the process of that. And actually, I remember when Max was like a tiny baby and for some reason he looked like, well, when he moved out of looking like a complete worm, which I think a lot of babies do when they're first born, into this old, it's like an old man phase where he looked like an old man when he wasn't even one yet. I remember actually just trying to teach him as much as I can. And probably looking back where we talk about areas that I wish maybe I'd been told certain things, or I really wanted to be great at things. I thought to myself when Max was born, it was like, I want to make sure that he can have a go at everything. And you know, you sometimes almost clash with your parents, actually, when as a sibling, you're trying to get them to catch a rugby ball at 2 years old. And actually, there was one memorable moment where I was trying to teach him to throw a rugby ball. And I span it at just, it was like I was throwing it to a professional rugby player and it smacked him square in the face. And I remember just going like, oh, as he fell over, and go, oh, he's all right. And it was that point in time where I kind of realized, oh, he's pretty resilient, actually. We could probably teach him a few more things. And as a result, I just became that older brother that will like throw him into anything. And I think he's a great learner as a result. Now, I remember teaching him chess, and the first time he beat me when he was like 8 years old, I quickly realized that maybe I'd created a monster, somebody that was far better at things than maybe I would ever be. But yeah, totally.
How do you think you've developed as a person then in showing some of those characteristics which are almost, as you say, paternal as an instinct versus the normal sort of sibling to sibling relationships that exist?
I've had conversations with my dad about this and how it's actually really strange watching your sibling growing up. And I think a lot of the learning curves that my dad talks about going through when he was raising us, I just feel like you almost bring forward. I think a lot of humans, a lot of people in their younger years spend time being quite arrogant or being very almost like obnoxious without knowing it, because there's this element of like, I'm indestructible, it's just me, myself and I. There's a kind of lone wolf mentality. And a lot of the time for other adults when they have kids, it's almost like a humbling experience, and you'll see people on the other side of parenthood as much more rounded, much more approachable and engaging people. And actually, I think if one thing happened as being an older brother of much younger siblings, it would probably be that I just learned to be a bit more understanding of other people a bit sooner, or at least I try to be. And as we've talked about before, I think it's that attempt to see something from a new perspective that for me is really important.
This new role brings us back to bedtime stories, because now it's you doing the reading. What is it about the ritual of books at bedtime that excites you?
I think it's not so much about the books itself, but the process of stepping back from the noise of the world. You know, we talked about nature and the impact of walking into wildlife and feeling like you're completely at peace with the world. And actually, when you're reading a bedtime story, having that complete focus on one task just for a moment to reflect on the writing and listen to a story, even if it involves getting kind of kicked in the face by your younger siblings sometimes, or they're trying to dance around the bed rather than listen to the story, actually that whole process is just quite calming. And for them, it's like you're just trying to help them go to sleep. But for you and for the person reading the story, it's like, actually I'm also stepping back from doing work and trying to run at a million miles an hour to just slow down, listen to a new perspective and focus on something very simple. And I find that quite relaxing.
Now, I do a lot of bedtime stories as well, obviously, having two little girls.
Can you relate to the madness?
Well, what I was going to say is that it's hard to explain why, but would you agree with me that there are some books that, as an adult, they're enjoyable to read, and others which are just a bit more of a slog?
For me, there are some books that just seem to go on and on. And actually, I'm not going to name names because I don't think it's fair to the people that have written them. But I do totally agree with you that sometimes those books can feel like a slog. And actually, when you're going through them and they seem to just go round and round in circles rather than actually teaching something, I do find myself getting a little bit bored with it. But at the same time, you talk about the books that are really great to read as an adult. And there's this book called I Talk Like a River. I don't know whether you've heard of it, but it only came out in the past year, I think. And actually, I read it on my own because a lot of the time I find myself reading picture books almost as research. And it was something that maybe I couldn't read it to a child. Maybe I would, maybe it's a bit too slow, maybe. It builds up quite slowly, but it's so profound. And it's all about speech and somebody that has I think it's either like a stutter or can't speak properly. And by the end of the story, it's quite emotional, actually. You feel like you've been on this journey with a child that lacked confidence because they couldn't speak properly and then learned to embrace their difference. And sometimes those kinds of stories are just really impactful.
Was there a single moment then when you thought about writing something yourself, or did it just sort of bubble up gradually?
I was very conscious, I think, of the aspiration to write a book. And it's actually because whilst we were on holiday one year and I was reading Max and Emily bedtime stories, I found myself, and it was Julia Donaldson's stories, actually, who wrote The Gruffalo. I'm sure everyone will know of her stories. Reading them and listening to the kind of rhythm and rhyme and thinking, I love the challenge of this. Like, it's quite short, so surely I could give it a stab quite quickly and work out whether I'm getting anywhere with it. And I sat down with my stepmom after putting them to bed that evening and said to her, like, why do more people not write stories? And she said, well, it's tricky, you know, it's not as easy as you might think. And I said, well, I think I could write a story. And she said, well, go on then. And so it was at that point in time where there was quite a clear direction for me, almost that line in the sand that we talk about, where I was like, right, I've got to give this a go now. And it wasn't as easy as I thought, to be honest, Lewis. I started off looking at history stories because I thought, actually, let's start off by taking stories that already exist and see whether I can turn them into a rhyming children's book. And I read back this rhyming story about Henry VIII to my parents and just watched their face drop in, like, they were just like, this is awful, Will, the rhyme's off, it doesn't work. And I was totally crushed by it, but at the same time I was like, okay, let's take that on board. And a couple months later, actually, while I was in second year of uni accommodation, I started off writing my own stories and giving them a go. And I think I'd written one about this crazy neighbor. The second one was then about the world's biggest paper aeroplane. And then the third one was The Shrew with the Flu. And I actually finished a manuscript for that in my third year uni bedroom and just kind of looked at it and was like, ah, this is all right. This seems to be okay. But I quite care about this story, so I'm not sure I can share it with anyone. And I felt very attached to it. And it wasn't until my flatmate at the time, I was going to stay at his house for a couple of nights on a weekend in Liverpool, and his mum was driving us back from uni and said, what had I been up to? And my friend was like, Will's been writing children's stories, which just felt like a really strange thing to be outed for to my flatmate's mum. But she said, she went, well, if you want some ruthless criticism, you know, and do not send this expecting nothing but compliments, I will give you the email of Sheila, my flatmate's grandma, and she's a retired primary school teacher, and she will be completely frank with you. And I sent the manuscript to her after a little bit of, you know, to's and fro's, thinking about whether I wanted that criticism. And she wrote back to me saying, Will, this is crying out for illustration. I would love to read this to the kids if I was still at the school. You need to show this to some more people. And that from there, the journey began, I suppose.
You talked earlier about, you know, reading picture books as research. I think it's really fair to say that the way in which children are told stories has evolved quite quickly. You've got children's stories being told through creators like John Clarkson, who did I Want My Hat Back, which is entirely dialogue driven, and there's no explanation of character, there's no explanation of background, but it's just all told in dialogue and pictures. It's a really clever way, I think, of telling stories to children, because it shows that you don't need all of that descriptive stuff as well. And then as you mentioned the sort of the rhyming element, Julia Donaldson, obviously like a master of that, but also people like Rachel Bright, who did The Bear Who Stared, and The Lion Inside as well. I think what excites me about the way in which children's stories are being told now is that they're not so formulaic. There's definitely different ways of doing it and different types of stories that are being brought to life as well. So it must have been quite exciting for you to sort of throw your hat into the ring.
I'm so happy that you mentioned that, because something I feel really passionately about is this kind of level of innovation and doing something differently. And when it comes to picture books, you mentioned about you have these entirely visual driven books, and I totally agree. They are so clever. And even someone like David Litchfield is a huge inspiration of mine, and the drawings he does just tells a story in itself. But then on the other side of it, there's this book which I think is called This Book Has No Pictures or something like that. And it's all words, but it feels like you're seeing something, which is a bit of a strange concept. But I totally agree with you that you can switch and swap formats. And the key thing is that it's enjoyable for the reader and the kid, for me. And actually, I've got manuscripts that I'm sitting on now, which I'm really excited to share with publishers, that are completely driven by their interactiveness with the audience. And actually, where there's still so much room to run for authors out there, I think it's being more interactive, trying to use more visuals, trying to use more words in other places. And actually, can you flip the format on its head? And actually, if that works, does it make it a better experience for the reader? I think a lot of the motivation that is driving the market nowadays comes from a place of wanting to satisfy the reader as opposed to the writer writing for themselves. And this is something I was talking to a friend about recently, that something that I feel is quite unique maybe in the way that I write in my process versus the way a lot of other people write is, I think a lot of people write for themselves, and I do write for myself as well. But when I'm writing picture books for kids, I'm really writing for them. I much more see it as, you know, when I read it out loud, do I see them smiling when they read this? Do I see them laughing? I kind of don't care if it makes me laugh or not. It's a bit of like I just want the person that picks up the book and that person on the other end to leave the story feeling better than they came into it. So when it comes to innovation, I think it's so exciting what can be done and is being done.
Rewinding a little bit, because you've explained when you wrote the manuscript for The Shrew with the Flute and how it came through a period of lots of different stories that you were exploring. Where did the idea for The Shrew come from?
So I found myself looking for a protagonist that was kind of small and adorable and relatable. And, you know, something that always comes to mind is a mouse. And I think we see them over and over again in children's stories. And so my mission at the beginning was, how can I find something that is as small and endearing as a mouse, but is different? And I came across shrews whilst I was doing some research, and having read into them and their characteristics and the fact that that a lot of the book is actually completely factual, believe it or not. So shrews spend their whole life starving, and just like Shrew in the story tries to gobble up the forest because he just kind of can't get enough food, that is quite true to real life. And actually, shrews just became this obsession when I was researching them. It was like, okay, they've got these tiny eyes that they can't really use. That seems completely ridiculous to me, but also lends itself to a character. They've got these massively big noses, which it's like, it's just like, why do they need such massive noses? And then I realized that they wholly rely on their sense of smell to hunt. So they've got this massive appetite and they're really restricted in the senses they can use to hunt. And it's kind of like all of these odds are stacked against them in a way that makes the character, I think, quite endearing. And you kind of just want them to succeed as a result. So that's how I ended up landing on a shrew, as random as it seems.
Was the environmental angle a conscious decision, or did it just kind of flow that way as a story?
I think it flowed that way, and it's a bit of a shame now that I'm so aware of those feelings and my attachment to the environment, because at the time when I wrote The Shrew with the Flu, I didn't know it meant so much to me. And it wasn't until I read the story aloud to my family that they were like, oh, that kind of sounds like a angle on the environment. And when I read it back, I was like, yeah, it does. And actually, through revisions of the story, I found it getting more and more that way and really leaning into that aspect. But you're absolutely right that the initial manuscript that I wrote didn't come from a place of, consciousness. It really just eats its way into my work. And I think often with those things, they do seem to sneak their way in.
Let's talk about illustrations, because as we've talked about, for many children's books, it's a huge part of how the story is told. Did you have a certain look in mind while you were writing and thinking about how the story develops?
So the second I read the story back, I could visualize it. In fact, whenever I'm writing a story, I can normally see how it would look in the book as I'm writing it. So as strange as that might sound, it is that visualization that I find helps me with the writing and helps take me on that journey as a writer. And so when I finished The Shrew with the Flu and sought about finding an illustrator, what really mattered to me was that we could find something that felt warm and endearing. And also, when we talk about Enid Blyton and like the faraway tree and that kind of stuff, that element of mythical and magical and something that kind of feels like anything could happen in these woods. And I remember looking through loads and loads of illustrators and landing on Jennifer Davison's page and looking at this illustration she had done of a monkey with really long hair. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, if you can draw a monkey with fur like that and make it look that good, and the jungle looked brilliant and vivid and really enticing for almost like a younger mind, I was thinking this would be perfect for a shrew. And even now when people message me about the book, their first comments are normally, I love the illustrations. Like I love how vivid and saturated the colors on the page look. And I'm totally in agreement with them. I think Jen's done an amazing job with it.
You talked a little bit about testing the waters with Sheila, the head teacher. Did you test the book with other experts? Did you read it to your younger siblings? What other kind of soundboards did you use to make sure that you were onto a winner?
I've got far too many stories for all of these things, but when I was looking for people to give me feedback, I talk about reading my initial stories in front of my family and sometimes them getting completely shot down. And as crushing as that was, I think it actually spurred me on to just test it with more people, because I was like, hold on, if I tweak this, then the worst that's going to happen is I get the same response. But more often than not, it's going to be slightly better than it's awful. So having shown it to Sheila, I then sent it round. it must have been at least 30 people, probably 50. And actually, 2 weeks, I think it was, before Jen was supposed to start illustrating the book, where her agent had said to me, we need the manuscript now. We need it finalized. You know, we can't have any spelling errors, anything like this. I had agreed to meet with this local theatre person, actually, called Brooke Tate, who, in fact, is now releasing his own story. And he agreed to sit down with me and just have a look through it, because I did have this vision in mind at one point in time that it would make for a play. And he went through it, and to be honest, he kind of ripped it apart, but at the same time said, it's a brilliant story, I love it, but this can change and this can change. I kind of watched him go through the manuscript and almost like sing it out loud to himself, like a real professional musician. And I was slightly in awe of that, like, element of perfection when it came to the manuscript. I was kind of like, why was I not singing it out loud when I wrote it? But when he handed it back to me, and I thought, okay, thanks so much, like, it's great to have all of this advice, but oh my god, this needed to be sent into Jen yesterday. So I went home and spent the next like 2 days just flat out on my computer pulling things in and editing it. And then at the end, I was like, right, Jen, I've got something, and sent it off to the agent. And looking back at it now, I was like, actually, that's probably where we made the most progress. And inviting his criticism and his feedback is what made The Shrew, the Flu, the story you see today. So I'm massively grateful for everybody that offered to cast an eye over it over that time.
When it came to the day of publication, how were you feeling about sort of birthing this work?
I love that choice of word. Funnily enough, it does feel like you're birthing a book, and probably more so for me than a lot of people, because I'd gone through the roller coaster ride of a crowdfunding campaign in the run-up to it. But in all honesty, when I got to publication day, I was full of excitement. I remember driving along a road and just I had music on, the windows down, and I was like totally happy in that moment, because I felt like I'd accomplished something which I'd been striving to achieve in so long. But at the same time, there was that anxiety around, what if people don't like it? You know, I've got these books that I care about and I love. Maybe what if the first thing I read is a bad review? Or what if the first bit of feedback is something that kind of hurts me? So I think it was a set of two different emotions. I think it was complete and utter euphoria, and also complete apprehension around how people would react to it. But that's really where I think all of the best things come from. And when you care about something, that anxiety for me is a real symptom of love for a project.
And what has the response been like?
I'm excited. I always get excited when I'm talking about the response to The Shrew, the Flu, because people have been awesome, Lewis. Like, I look at Amazon and we've now got like 75 star reviews, which is just a bit beyond me. I literally read through them kind of every other weekend. I feel like I look back through the same reviews over and over again, which is, it can't be good for my ego. But at the same time, it's like, sometimes you just feel like you need that confidence boost. And looking at the stockist, that I've now got a gazillion photos in my phone feed of selfies that I've taken with stockists in and around the Bristol area. And even getting involved with people like Back to Nature. And now I've had some talks with the Ministry of Eco-Curriculum around potentially incorporating it into school curriculums and discussing more about the environment. The whole process of engaging with communities that have read the book has been such a rewarding experience, and something that I've never experienced before.
You've been into local schools as well, haven't you? Taking the story direct to the kids. What has that been like?
Well, first of all, it all started in person and then went to Zoom, and that was an adjustment in itself. But the look on kids' faces when you read a story that they're enjoying, it's just, it's so fulfilling. And I can't quite explain to people the magic of being in a room where everyone feels totally focused on this one experience. And I make a conscious effort to make all of my school visits as engaging as possible and interactive. And where I had started off finishing the story and kind of saying, right, guys, so can you reflect back to me what Shrew's story, you know, what the message was of that? I read a tweet by Michael Morpurgo, actually, that was talking about how alienating that can be for kids that don't want to try and work out your own book for you, because it can feel embarrassing if they get it wrong. And ever since then, rather than asking them what the lesson was, I just asked them to tell me about their experiences in the world and what they thought of the book. And when you ask a child to tell you a story, when you invite that contribution, oh my word, it's wild. Kids have some crazy stories. I remember this one girl at a visit I did to a school recently. She just randomly puts her hand up as though I had asked if anyone had any questions at the end. And of course, most of the kids that have their hand up actually have a statement to make, rather than they just kind of take the floor and go for it. And, you know, power to them. I might have done the same thing when I was their age. This girl puts her hand up and I asked her what questions she had. And she went, the other day I gathered up 100 conkers and planted them in my mum's garden. So now we're growing a conker forest. And I found it hysterical, because first of all, it was this idea that she had managed to smuggle 100 conkers into her mum's garden without her mum noticing. And the second thing was the thought of her mum then not realizing that 100 trees were going to be sprouting out the garden in a matter of months. So some of the things that you hear on these visits is just hilarious, and also just like totally fulfilling and rewarding.
We talked a little bit about the innovation around telling stories to children. And one of the other things that I think is really interesting is linking what's on the pages with real life in that way that you described. So the conclusion of your story is based on this concept of restoring the natural world. And something that you've done is create seed bombs, which mean that children can have this tangible connection between the story and growing their own slice of nature. Maybe not a horse chestnut forest, but, you know, a wildflower meadow or something like that. What's sort of the inspiration and thinking behind that?
I love that you've touched on that. And actually, yeah, the thought firstly of that, the chestnut forest, is something that's quite, I think, would be quite shocking to parents. So it's nice to empower kids with almost the tools to create something that is meaningful and impactful, but also not in any way destructive or disruptive for people's gardens. When it comes to the seed bombs themselves, my relationship with the company that creates them, called Kabloom, is just incredible. And I've met the CEO, Darren, and I absolutely think the world of him. The way that he values nature and puts the kind of interaction with the brand at the forefront of everything they're doing was something that appealed to me when I first looked to make these seed bombs. And yeah, you're spot on with the way you talk about, you kind of read the book, and a lot of the time I felt like kids were going, oh wow, I want to go out in nature and do more, and they feel quite motivated to go and have an impact, and they feel more connected to nature than they would have before. But at the same time, when you've just given them a book, they're restricted in what they can do, because a lot of the time they don't have that first call to action that would enable them to do it. So the feeling around that was, look, if we created the Shrew with the Flu seed bomb, and I'm sure if people Googled that now, they'd be able to find what we have created. They can actually go and take those feelings and in a kind of continuous link to the book, go and take action in the great outdoors and go and soak these grenade-shaped seed bombs in water, launch them into their gardens and just watch as flowers grow. So it feels like the perfect collaboration for me.
What is next for the shrew and for yourself?
I think next for me is write more stories and talk to more people that can get them in front of more families. So I've had conversations with publishers, and somebody that has quickly become almost a friend of mine is David Litchfield, who is like an incredible best-selling author that I've mentioned many times before. And yeah, I think the aspirations are, first of all, spreading through far and wide and trying to create more of a program for schools and families that can enable them to not just read the book, but engage with nature in a new and maybe a more profound way. And then when it comes to my writing, you know, I've got so many manuscripts and so many stories that I want to be able to bring to life, that it is just finding the right people to help me do that. So I'm very particular about almost like agents and people like that. But actually, when it comes to sharing it with the world, it's just a case of, look, can you help me elevate where it is now? Can we get it to more families? Have you got a school that is wanting to do more outdoor activities or wanting to engage kids in nature more? And trying to find those people and engage with them and help them achieve, you know, the things that they want to do.
Before we go, where can people find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
So I post quite regularly on all my socials, which is literally just Will HD Official across everything. You know, it's not Will HD, I went for it, couldn't get it everywhere. So Will HD Official. And then aside from that, you know, Amazon, bookshop.org, Foils, all of your usual places for finding the book. And if you go to Kabloom's website, which is the people that create those seed bombs, you can buy both the book and the seed bombs together. So I'd really encourage people to go and look them out and support them, because they're an eco-friendly guerrilla gardening company that is close to my heart. So that's probably the best way.
Will, thank you so much for your time. You've been a fantastic guest. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.